Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lapointe Vin Group conference call. I will now turn over the call to David Lapointe Vin. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 2018 conference call. I guess I'd say by word of the time, though, we're already in 2018, and what an interesting time that it is, especially in the investment markets. Obviously, we came up finishing a decent year in investing. It's not as gangbuster in terms of returns as you would look at if you looked at the headline numbers of the Dow. That being said, that's because in Canada, we had a lackluster year of only returns of about 5%. Bond yields, bond prices dropped. Therefore, the return on a bond portfolio was close to zero. U.S. stocks, which comprise the largest portion of our holdings, did well. That being said, they did well with a currency that was up about 7% or 8% on the year. That has to come off return. If your stock went up 17% and your currency took away 7% of that, then you're back of the napkin. When you look at your Canadian dollar statement, you're up 10%. That being said, it's been a decent year. It's also been an unbelievable eight-year run since the 2009 bottom. That being said, where the heck do we go from here? One of my clients reminds me, he says, "Okay, you've had a good year last year, but what are you going to do for me now? What have you done for me lately?" Our challenge is always to get it right, not just in the past, but going forward. As you know, clients that have been investing with mine for 20 years knows that when they first came on board, I favored the bond market. That was yields, old-timers will remember yields of well north of 10%. Even when rates went down to 7% and even 6%, bonds represented some exceptional value, especially relative to stocks. When you hear about valuation or bonds, it's always relative one to the other. Let's remember that capital must find a home. In an era where interest rates are 5%, 6%, or 7%, money gets sticky in terms of staying in cash or in the bond market because it's doing not too badly. In 2009, rates were cut essentially around the world to close to a 0% return, in some cases negative, so you had to pay a penalty to be in cash. Yet at the bottom of 2009, just to give you a poster child, you could have bought Johnson & Johnson at $50 a share to represent a dividend north of 5%, and it was highly secure dividend, being the companies involved in things like sutures and Band-Aids and Tylenol. Here we are today, and Johnson & Johnson is well over $140, yielding just 2.3%. Where do we go from here? Let's look at everything on a relative basis. The consensus is that the Standard & Poor's 500, and again, you break up the earnings relative to the index. If a stock is 2% of the index, and you break down the earnings on a same relative basis, you get an earnings for the whole market. If we look at the consensus in earnings for 2018, we see that the expectations of profits will come in at $151. Now, that represents an index that's trading roughly at about 2,790. What does that mean? That means if we bought every stock in the S&P 500 on a relative basis, and we spent $2,790 on $151 of profits, we'd have an earnings yield of 5.41%. Now, it's interesting that all throughout this, as I've been struggling to keep investors invested in stocks, the earnings yield has been about north of 5%. Valuations are actually strikingly similar the entire way that we've been in the market. What's been happening is earnings have been surging, and with the tax reform in the United States of U.S. taxes going from 35% to 21%, this represents a tremendous boost to earnings, which is why you've seen a stock market surge justifiable in the last couple of months. And so, you know, where are we now? So in the United States, bonds are yielding, 10-year bonds are yielding about 2.55%. So that being said, I mean, those yields are higher than they've been in quite some time. But 2.55% relative to an earnings yield on the stock market of 5.41 still says that the most likely outcome in 2018 is that capital will likely not favor cash, not favor bonds, but the cheaper valuation is in stocks. So, you know, that being said, I'll point out some risks, okay? And that is, you know, what are we looking for? The problem is the bond yielding 2.55% is a, you know, an interesting benchmark, but it's still way, way, and despite the fact that yields are up, way, way below the historical yields on bonds, and in fact, they're way below where bond yields ought to be. It was an interesting chart recently showing the New York Federal Reserve. The United States is made up of seven regions that report on their interest rate outlook to the U.S. Federal Reserve, which ultimately makes an interest rate decision. The New York Fed is arguably the most powerful one, but they have a leading indicator of inflation. And that has actually been strikingly accurate about telling us where inflation will be in the next 6 months. And their indicator just hit 3%. Now, 3% is a number that is absolutely unsustainable with bond yields at 2.55%. So if you're asking Lapointe, then what is the one thing he's watching is inflation. Because if bond yields start to surge, that's going to put stock valuations into question, and that will change our thesis. I want to point out another thing here in terms of risks. In 2009 and 2010 and 2011, the U.S. Federal Reserve that sets really U.S. rates and then global rates, because they're all, most interest rates are priced relative to the United States. U.S. Federal Reserve gave us the information. They told us interest rates will stay very low for an unusually long period of time. If you can remember, we bought our clients' bonds in 2009 and 2010 because the U.S. Fed was handing us the information that you know, we were buying 4% bonds, and the U.S. Fed says, no, rates are, cash was paying zero, long bonds were paying four. U.S. Fed was giving us the information that that was going to be a profitable trade. The market didn't believe the Fed, but the Fed stayed true to their word. It's interesting today that the U.S. Federal Reserve is plotting out a two-year scenario where rates just went up in December, and they're plotting a scenario that interest rates will be raised at least six more times in the next 2 years. And it's very interesting that these same people that didn't believe the Fed back then don't believe the Federal Reserve Board now. So the one to watch is inflation. The thing to watch is the U.S. Fed. Now, that being said, the other thing that could derail the stock markets is if the U.S. imminently went into recession and then earnings begin to collapse. That is highly improbable. As I've pointed out many times, the interest rate outlook as measured by the yield curve, which measures a dot plot of interest rates starting from the left axis of your overnight rate, then your 1 month, 2 month, 3 months, up to 5, 10, and 20-year bonds, is still very positively sloped. Until that inverts, you've not gone into recession ever in U.S. history. This will highly improbable be the first recession. It will not be the first recession without an inverted yield curve. So that says earnings are still stable. But we've had bear markets before. We've had stock market declines where earnings are still going up. And that's because how fast did the U.S. Federal Reserve raise rates? They're indicating a very, very slow rate increase, which would be positive for this year in the stock market. So that being said, we are still gravitating capital to stocks, but we are less enthusiastic about stocks than we were a few years ago, even a year ago, because things have gone up and it's harder to find the fantastic bargains that we have been finding in the past, but they're out there and they're typically in some smaller mid-sized companies. And you know, it's interesting in Canada. Well, I'll go back for a second, and that is, it's also interesting that in the last 2 months, the inflationary stocks, the materials, the energy stocks, the airlines have been doing very, very well and going up. The golds, the utilities and the consumer staples and the telecoms have been lagging and going down. So the deflationary stocks that do well under very low inflation are going down, and the inflation stocks are going up. So again, one to watch. We've been guiding our portfolios a little bit more towards the inflationary side of the and away from the disinflationary side of the accounts. So we're not sitting idle. It's going to be a challenge here. I cannot give you a year-end forecast because it's going to change based on the keys to the castle is the U.S. Federal Reserve Board. So that's it. Happy to discuss one-on-one. I have two questions that were emailed in. The first question is about how do we protect ourselves and what do we do about Trump? Very worried about Trump. Well, you know, I was on a conference call right around the U.S. election time, and as I said, I'm not a fan of Trump, don't misconstrue this, but I said Trump would be good for the stock markets, and that's proven correct. You always have to worry a little bit about what Trump could say. He can tweet anything or say anything. There's a State of the Union address coming up in the next few weeks in the United States. I worried about trade protection. I think that that could be very detrimental to Canada, but I also think that there's a rumor floating that Trump is going to float the idea of tariffs on China. That's troubling. I mean, anyone that wants to look at their history books and read about the 1930s called food haulings and trying to deal with the U.S. trade deficit through protectionism, many argue that that was one of the causes that the recession turned into the depression. So we're going to watch that carefully. I would also point out that the stock market is vulnerable to a correction. And when I say vulnerable, I'm not saying recession, but if clients will remember, we had we've seen 10% correction 2014, 2015, 2016. And we don't worry too much about corrections, except that we love to buy new stocks at bargain valuations. But why I say we're vulnerable to a correction is that there's actually three sources that we can gauge whether investors have become overly optimistic. When there's too much optimism, the market's vulnerable to some piece of bad news to send things lower. One of my clients was asking the other day, why is it that sometimes the stock market ignores bad news? Ignoring bad news is when the market's already pessimistic and the nervous Nellies aren't in, so they can't sell. But recently we've seen three pieces of data which suggest that there's too much optimism all of a sudden. There are two surveys. One is of individual investors. And the recent survey showed that there are 60% of the population that's bullish and only 15% bearish, with the rest neutral. And that 15% bearish is the lowest, bearish meaning negative. That 15% negative number was the lowest number we've seen in this entire stock market cycle. So those are typically can represent short-term tops. The other survey is actually of the stock brokerage community, professionals in the market, and it shows exactly the same reasoning. Number that 60% bullish and 15. So nobody's nervous. That's why I titled the call, Where Are the Bears? I can tell you my clients, for the last 8 years, we have been going from one call to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. I'm very worried. We have, you know, not one person in general, but I remember a call. There's no way the Dow at 18,000 won a bubble. In fact, Trump, in his election campaign, called the Dow a bubble at 17,000. and be foolish to go in. And now it's a screaming buy now that he's president. So short-term cautious. So this is why sometimes you're going to see some sales and not necessarily a repurchase. The third reading is the price of put options, which is typically in times of fear, a price of a put option is measured by the volatility index. It skyrockets. And I liken it to buying house insurance. If there's no break-ins and no fires in your area, house insurance gets cheaper. If all of a sudden there's a rash of fires or a rash of break-ins in your area, house insurance goes up. And the price of put options is unusually low, which says that nobody's worried because every time you buy a put option and nothing happens, you've thrown away $1,000 or whatever the price of the premium is. Our strategy is, ironically, to kind of stay invested but get a few puts. And it's funny because we stay fully invested and people go, why did you buy those put options? Well, we bought it for insurance and hopefully insurance we don't have to collect. Anyway, I've spoken as I have for my 20 minutes. And I'll go through two questions that were emailed. Oh, yeah, the other one was Trump and the other one was just about the real estate market, and I'm not sure why anyone would ask me that question because I've been negative on it for quite some time, saying that the valuations were at bubble levels. I quote Marty Zweig saying that, you know, a reason something goes up is because it's going up. And typically you need a catalyst to change that direction. And that catalyst in Canada is higher rates. And, you know, in the summer of 2016, we hit a record low on the 5-year Canada, 0.47%. That rate hit 2% today. And, you know, people were borrowing even as recently as 6 months ago at 2.39% on a 5-year bank mortgage. Well, that rate is TD and Royal just raised the rates to 3.56, which is a staggering increase relative to where it was in the summertime. And as of January the 1st, you need to qualify for a mortgage at 2% higher than whatever your rate is. So if you just went to Royal and you got a 5-year mortgage at 3.56, you now have to show that you can afford to borrow that $1 million at 5.56. Now that is a strikingly different number, and it means that Canadians will be able to afford roughly 45% less house than they could just 6 months ago. I also, you know, want to point out, I had a conversation with a client who's got 3 investment properties, all in East Vancouver, and market value about $5 million for the 3 properties. So we talked about it. Well, how much revenue do they generate? About $126,000 a year. So back of the napkin, after inflation and a little bit of maintenance, it's $100,000 a year of taxable income. Well, you know, what's the value of those properties? Well, it's $5 million. So if we look at that, we talk about the earnings yield of stock is 5.41. That's just 2%. Now, I guess if we look back 30 years ago, in fact, if we look back about 35 years ago to the early 80s, you see the interest rates were 20%. Well, capitalization rates of real estate was typically about 20% because it's all relative to interest rates. So if you can get 19.5% on the Canada Savings Bonds, you're going to need about a 20% return on your investment properties. So those if the income was $100,000, typically in 1981 you'd be buying about $500,000 to get $100,000 of income. Well, at half of 1% in the spring of 2016, I guess 2% looked like a pretty good deal. But now that interest rates are going up, the 2% capitalization rate may be a thing of the past. So let's remember that same property, just based on cash flow, has gone from $500,000 to $5 million. And many real estate experts have become, look like geniuses, but I'm not sure that going forward in a rising rate environment, you're going to see the same decreases in cap rates. And so let's remember, if the cap rates go to 4%, the values were of the property is now actually just from going from 2 to 4, which is highly probable, the valuation of those properties becomes $2.5 million from $5 million. Those are the two questions that were emailed. I'm happy to open it up and go with a couple more. And as I say, it's going to be an interesting year. Operator, can you see if there's anybody on the line with some questions or tell them how to ask a question?
Yeah, definitely. So if anybody wants to ask a question, it's 01. And we have somebody queuing up. We're just going to take us a few moments to get their name.
Operator, don't worry about the names. Just you just fire them.
Okay. Well, we'll go with the first line. Please go ahead. Actually, the problem is that we have no way of identifying them.
Okay.
So,
yeah. If you have anyone in the queue, you can open it up.
Yeah. So first question comes from Chris, from John. Chris, please go ahead.
Hello. Why do you refuse to sell the losers at year end and buy them back 30 days later?
Hi, John.
Hi.
Yeah, we've been through this before, but one of the greatest investment strategies is, and in fact, the Stock Traders Almanac actually has a term for it, and they call it the only free lunch on Wall Street. And, you know, if you look at the best strategy for stocks, like the only one that has a 90% accuracy, is going in early December and buying stocks that are other people are tax loss selling. And the average return for 60 days is 11% return in 60 days. So if you look at the 11%, I would say in Canada it's much higher than that. And if you look in Canada, a tax loss is someone like yourself at your tax bracket, the maximum gain on a stock that would go to zero would be about 20% because of the tax rate. So if your stock's in half, it's 10%. So you've just sold something and you've eliminated the entire tax benefit of it. And as I said, John, we're happy to go through your previous tax losses. I can 100% guarantee you that even after taxes, that it has been a foolish trade. Okay? So we're happy to go through that one-on-one. But, you know, my job is to keep you guys from losing money, and that's a bad strategy. We want to do the opposite of that. Okay, thanks. Thanks for the question. Next question.
Right. Next, we have a question from Neil Crofton. Please go ahead.
Hey, David. Hello.
Hey.
Just wanted to get your opinion here on the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency status that it's had for, you know, 40 or 50 years here.
Awesome question.
This is what's happening with the Chinese and the yuan, and the contracts apparently that they're setting up with the Saudis to pay them in yuan instead of U.S. dollars. Apparently,
Thanks, Neil. I mean, the Saudis have been rumored to use another currency for as long as I've been in the business, and the reality is, and we've talked about this before, there isn't a currency with enough liquidity because oil is such a commodity that's traded on a world in the billions on a daily basis. Most countries in the world now, their reserves are in multi-currencies, but there's no way the yuan can be accepted for oil because there isn't enough of it floating around. It just can't happen. You know, the Chinese will float the idea. They as soon as the euro came out, they said they were going to use euro. They haven't. They will do some contracts in euro, but it's the U.S. dollar. But that being said, let's talk about the U.S. dollar for a moment. Trump has been very good for keeping the dollar low. That's been very good for U.S. stocks. You know, in Canada, we're seeing the reprieve of currencies. What worries me I can talk about the U.S. dollar, but I can also talk about the Canadian dollar. I think the U.S. dollar is going to have trouble staying down because I think that they're underpricing the reality that the U.S. Fed will continue to raise rates. I mean, German 10-year bonds yesterday were 0.54. I didn't look at them today. U.S. is at 2.55. So it's going to be hard for the U.S. dollar to perpetually devalue. I mean, everybody loves a devalued currency from the central bankers. I don't personally, but everybody loves their currency to devalue to make more accounts. So you've got this world of competitive devaluations. In Canada, I got to point out that our household indebted level is shocking. And Stefan Marion, my old cohort from National, says it's okay because we're not as bad as some Scandinavian countries in Hong Kong. When you start to say we're not bad because I found two other bad parties, it's like my son saying, you know, you got caught, doing a bad thing. Well, it's not as bad as so-and-so. It's still bad. From a Canadian perspective, we got a problem, and that is massive consumer spending and ever increasing levels of household debt. And our household indebtedness, from being at a record, still increased another 4% last year. And the problem with that is that 70% of your daily economy, your GDP, is just actually what we consume on a daily basis. So we don't have the numbers in, but it's about 2.8% growth in Canada last year. If you take out if we didn't pile on more debt, if we just spent what we had, the economy in Canada would have been zero. It's very interesting to see, in Canada, consumer spending actually increased in the fourth quarter. And it's almost right on script. When interest rates begin to rise, if we look at history, people get more debt, not less. They go, oh my God, honey, we better lock in some more debt. We're going to need some in the future. So there's been a bit of a reprieve of consumption and, number led by car sales, which is predominantly fueled by debt as well. So I would say that in Canada, the problem is rising rates will affect us and Scandinavia. And I'm not, if you notice, we don't own any Scandinavian real estate in our accounts or Scandinavian bank stocks. So therefore, I would suggest that Canada is vulnerable in the second half, especially as the U.S. raises. Tomorrow, Bank of Canada is going to decide. The market's pricing in a rate rise. I'm 50-50. I think Pelosi might just wait because of the new mortgage rules that are coming into effect. That being said, it's 50-50. Central bankers tend to follow the market expectations. But we'll see. I mean, every quarter point in Canada is a lot of money to a lot of mortgages. Bank of Montreal survey said that the highest amount of mortgage renewals are coming due in 2018. That 43% of all mortgages are coming due next year. That is a shocking number. And let's remember, if you've been rolling at 2.5, there's a big difference in your monthly. Recent survey, can't remember who did it, it was on BNN yesterday. 33% of Canadians, 33% are already in a position where they cannot pay their bills. They can't pay their mortgage, their visas, and their utility bills. It's shocking. On a number one expense for most Canadians is their debt, servicing debt in a rising rate environment. Probably won't end well. It'll be a second half Canada underperforming. And instead of consumers fueling a stronger economic activity in Canada than the rest of the world. That'll be a problem in the second half. It'll be an interesting year. It's hard to get too negative on the Canadian dollar. Oil has a seasonally strong period between middle of December to the end of April. But second half, I'm going to guess Canadian dollar is back to 75. But that'll it won't be 75 at a $70 oil handle, though. Who knows? Stephen Shork of the Shork Report, probably the smartest guy on oil, is getting quite concerned about oversupply again. There's a Saudi Aramco stock offering. The Saudis want to keep oil high to off some of their stocks at a high level. Unfortunately, one of the biggest producer on the planet that isn't a member of OPEC is the United States. And let's remember, a few years ago, they were 4.2 million barrels. They're going to have a record 10 million barrels of oil, which is only 10% less than all of Saudi Arabia produces. Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Operator, thanks, Dale. Can we go on to the next question?
Sure. Next question comes from Mark Wu. Please go ahead.
Well, hi, David. I was just wondering if you could just comment on if you feel that the U.S. dollar is going to increase. Do you think that that will weigh in on material prices and keep them depressed, or do you think that inflationary rates will offset that and the materials are the place to be?
Excellent question. I think I'm not wildly bullish of the U.S. dollar. I just don't think it'll fall. I think it'll rise slightly, but I think material prices is, you know, people need to position investment portfolios for what we call late cycle, which is, well, look, we love Johnson & Johnson. I can't see it going up in a rising rate environment, yielding just 2.3 and trading at 24 times earnings. And yet, some of these material stocks, which aren't making any money because materials have been so depressed, global demand is going to be strong, and there could be explosive turnarounds in some of these stocks. Again, we're not going to load up portfolios that are conservative into these sectors, but it's hard for me to be negative. I'm quite constructive on materials. So, good question. Okay, next question.
All right. Next question comes from Mark Spencer. Please go ahead.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, David. I have some questions about the U.S. dollar, but you've already answered them. Thank you.
All right. Mark, all right. I like gold bugs, so... Next question, operator.
All right. Next question comes from Sean Lawson. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, Sean.
A couple things. Just again on the Canada-U.S. dollar, if you're sitting on cash, at what point would you look at buying some more U.S. dollars, number one? And number two, as far as being a little nervous about where the market's at, what is your plan to protect on the downside so that maybe we don't get, you know, have to take the full brunt of a correction? Thanks.
Awesome. Hey, Sean, if you're still on the line,
yeah.
We happen to have, for the audience, one of the foremost, probably most powerful real estate guys in the city, in the south of the city in Steveston area. Are you seeing any effects sort of from Jan 1 of the new mortgage rules?
Not yet. I think it's still a little early for that. I do expect that at the bottom end of the market, you know, that's where you're really going to, you know, feel that. You know, where we are and, you know, a lot of Vancouver, it's kind of been a top-down market we've been dealing with for, you know, a long time now. And it's just heading towards Chinese New Year. And again, we're a little early in the beginning of this year, but it feels like we're ramping up a little bit. So, I mean, I think it's the cumulative effect that may, you know, we had the stress test come in. Tomorrow we'll find out about interest rates and maybe get some insight into how quickly they're going to move. And then I think that our NDP government is probably going to drop a grenade on us in February at the budget time. And my feeling is all three of those things may be enough to kind of turn things the other way. But right now it seems like we're gearing up for a decent Chinese New Year and beginning of spring.
Well, awesome. That was a nice little nice little call. So protect on the downside. I mean, these are sort of just some individual things. I'm happy with some U.S. exposure here and adding to that exposure around 80 cents. I think in the long run, it's we're going to look back and go, that was a great opportunity. We've seen it a few times and only to fall back. in terms of downside protection, I think it's being proactive and not being afraid to hold cash. I mean, from my perspective as a financial advisor, if we don't get the correction, someone will say, you know, hey, the market's up 15 and we did 8, you know. So I think a little bit of this is a call with one of the guys on the team, myself, any of the people on the team, and just go through your, you know, your own personal portfolios. We had a conversation with a client just a couple days ago, and he's been negative. He wanted to have more puts last year. He wanted to be in higher cash. And then I'm not very happy with my 6.5% return. Like, he's comparing against the market. Well, you can't have both. You can't have the upside of the market and buy a lot of protection or not be invested. I think it's just being proactive, and I think right now is a decent time not to be out, but to have a little bit more cash than normal. And corrections, as we did in 2014, 15, and 16, we use corrections to buy some unbelievable stocks. Corrections of 10% means some stocks are down 20 that you wanted to buy. So it's highly possible. December is the strongest month of the year, followed by January. If you remember, the last correction we saw was 2016. It was February. So who knows? But Sean, you and I will talk about that on an individual basis. Look forward to that.
Sounds good. Thanks, Dave.
Operator, we got one more question, and otherwise, if we didn't get your question, people just give us a drop us a line or an email or anything like that.
All right. So next question comes from Krista Vanderhoek. Please go ahead.
Hi, David. It's along the lines of Sean's question, but you had talked about put strategies there and using that to hedge kind of long tail risk. I take it that's turned on an individual account basis based on conversations we have with you, or is that something that is being done across the board?
We still run them on a discretionary basis, but if you're interested, you got and give us a call. I mean, we're trying to get them in the portfolios. Puts are not all that liquid, so the problem is we're getting a couple hundred contracts, which is kind of put it. I mean, it's amazing. For $1,000, you can buy a 7-month Royal Bank put that's 12% out of the money for $1,000. So for $1,000, you've got $100,000 of protection. It's unbelievably cheap. So took a $500,000 portfolio, you could literally for $5,000 stay invested and protect you from a problem. Now again, I picked Royal Bank because I think that there's an issue of vulnerability. Toronto house prices have gone down for 7 consecutive months. And yet in Toronto region, Royal Bank is reporting only 7 basis points of loan loss provision. That means only 7 out of 10,000 mortgages are in arrear, an all-time low. And look, when your house is in Toronto going up by $100,000, $200,000 a year, of course you don't default. You can get more credit. You can sell it in the worst-case scenario. I'll quote again Kyle Bass from the book The Big Short, the problem starts when real estate stops going up. If we see loan loss provisions ticking up even to 25, 30, 40 basis points, profitability of Canadian banks is going to get eroded dramatically, and you're going to see a big decline in year-over-year profits. Every year, the banks beat their numbers, and we just saw year-end, so it's typical to bring them down. You start to bring back some of the problems early into the new year. Fourth quarter, bank earnings are October 31st. So November, you report. Of course, it's all wonderful because it's year end. So we'll see what happens. It'll be very interesting to see in a rising interest rate environment with a highest G20 country of indebtedness.
Sounds good. Thank you. I'll probably be giving Mark a call, and we'll see if we can get a piece of that.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, everyone. Look forward to the year, and feel free to set up something that we can review on an individual basis. Okay, thanks, operator.
You're welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Lapointe-Vin Group Conference Call. Thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.